Let's see here. God. Oh.
Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance.
Oh. Everybody. God, this is awful.
Isn't there anything? Anything? Anything?
Listening to the radio these days can be distressing. Fortunately, here at CITR, our programmers choose the music that they play, so our charts reflect what people actually listen to. To find out what's really topping the charts, pick up a copy of Discorder magazine, or check us out online at CITR.ca. Unless, of course, you'd rather keep listening to the chart-topping single, Everybody Dance.
What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance. Everybody dance. Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance?
Everybody. But I wonder what would happen if you say what you want to say.
The Humanitarian Organization for Providing Empowerment, also known as HOPE, aims to work in partnership with marginalized societal groups in a way that shows awareness and respect for their backgrounds, cultures, and beliefs. We host mentorship programs for inner-city students, Warmth of Winter outreach programs for homeless residents of Vancouver, and annual conferences to challenge the stigma around various societal issues.
Are you weary of listening to Uncle's tired old war stories? Had enough of Zuzu's quest for father's favor? Do you want to hear tales worthy of the Fire Nation princess herself? Then tune in to Scald's Hall on CITR 101.9 FM and listen to the very best established and upcoming storytellers in the land. Do it, peasant, for your princess commands you.
Join us Fridays at 9 p.m. for the very best in spoken word entertainment.
Ty Lee, you're not thinking of changing the dial, are you? That's better.
CITR 101.9 FM. My name is David Love Jones, and the show is African Rhythms Radio. So welcome back again, and we've got a special holiday all-star edition tonight. And I've been telling you about the film I'm making on Jason Hoover. So we have him back, we've got Michael Ingram back, and we've got local gentleman Kirk Moses, who's going to be helping us with the making of this film also. So we're going to talk to him tonight as well. Welcome back, gentlemen, and welcome,
hey,
Kirk.
Buddy. What it look like,
hey,
that cool.
David. Hey, Kirk.
Yeah, well, we're getting quite a team together for this film, Jason. You getting excited?
Oh, man, I was excited. I was very excited. Matter of fact, when I got in the car tonight, I saw the Kirk. I said, wow, I could feel the vibes from Kirk.
Yeah.
He's going to definitely be part of the team.
Yeah.
Welcome to the team, David.
Awesome. Well, African Rhythms Radio is going to be a special edition tonight, but we're going to start with Billie Holiday.
She's Jason. The greatest.
Yeah. Lady Sings the Blues. Is that like an anthem of anthems?
It no is question she's an anthem. She's a walking anthem.
You couldn't have picked a better song.
Okay, well, let's check it out right now.
Tells her sad nothing to telling you, she's got 'em bad. But now the world will know she's never gonna sing them no more. 'Cause the blues ain't nothing but a pain in your heart when you get a bad start, when you and your man have to part. Ain't gonna just sit around and cry. I know I won't die, 'cause I love him. Lady sings the blues, I'm telling you, she's got a man. But now the world will know she's never gonna sing them no more, no
Yeah, you often don't want to talk about greatest singers or things like that, or, you know, people always ask you, what's your favorite or whatever. But, I mean, anybody who's had anything to do with jazz, I mean, how can you fault Billie Holiday? I mean, that's the ultimate in improvisation. She's exactly like Louis on trumpet, but in
that's right
vocal form.
That's know exactly right. She was trapped by her talent. And she reminded me of something that Chaka Khan said recently about how she'd go to a gig, she's going to the city, she goes to her room, she can't leave because everybody knows who she is, so she'll be bothered for autographs and other stupid stuff. And then she goes on stage and she says for that 2 hours or whatever, she can truly be who she is. Mm-hmm. And remember, Chaka had her own issues with substances as well. So now this is a constant fight for her. Imagine what it's like for Billie Holiday to have to endure all that on top of the era in which she's singing and with the demons of having to take drugs and finding no comfort anywhere else other than being on stage or in a recording studio.
Look at what it was like for her to look at other contemporary black singers around like her. Bessie Smith was left on the roadside.
That's right.
And they wouldn't take her to a local hospital. Mm-hmm. And so she died on the roadside. You know, this is how other talent was treated. You know, so, I mean, as I was saying in the break, Billie Holiday was blackballed. She could not work just over her heroin addiction. Like, that's, she was harshly treated. I mean, if she sounds like she's torn in pain or whatever, she was living.
She didn't have to work at it.
It was for real.
Exactly. That is real. And and in New York, being the way it was with cabaret licenses and stuff like that, they would use an excuse like that, being a substance abuser, to stop her from being on stage. And back then, they had some really antediluvian laws regarding how many people are on stage and the times they're at there. So she was screwed royally on top of being blacklisted.
Yeah.
And yet she managed to get all of that out when she sang.
Yeah. No, I mean, that song is... I mean, Billie's got so many songs that'll reach you. I mean, the truth is some of her stuff is so powerful, an example being A Gloomy Sunday, that they had to pull it off the radio.
That's right.
People were committing suicide.
I heard
so
Bjork try to attempt to do that song. She didn't do a bad job of it, but yeah, Gloomy Sunday was just like that. If you heard it, it put you in such a morose bag that a lot of people said, okay, I'm done. I mean, that's serious power.
Yeah. That's definitely a different kind of way to have to censor the radio. Mm-hmm. People are killing themselves. We got to pull this off. You know? But Jason, I wanted to mention Shirley Granger.
Yes.
Here she was, a local singer
in Vancouver. Yes, I had seen her perform live.
Yeah. And then you were saying there's some pretty good talent in this band. Like, she played on this, some kind of a schooner, the Black Eyes.
Well, there was Cora on bass, and there was Henry Young on guitar.
And Henry Young, did he play with Bobby Taylor?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
he was one of the first.
He's like a legendary local guitar player.
He is very legendary, but that's as far as it's gone. He never went, you know, he never traveled. He was known as Vancouver's Henry Young.
Chinese,
half Chinese.
Right, yeah. But no, he seems like he's, you know, when people cite the local talents, his name definitely comes up.
A lot. Yeah. He did a lot of local recordings for a lot of people.
But I mean, the Gastown Schooner, a boat, gets to release its own record. You know, Shirley Granger, she's just singing on the boat. And they put out a vinyl in 77 on a Vancouver local label. Pretty well. Did you remember anything about this?
Oh, I remember seeing her sing at the Cave. She'd open for acts that would come in the Cave, you know, big acts that would come in. And she'd be an opener. Shirley had a great personality. She was a little bit more of a drunk, though. She drank a lot of stuff. I don't know what she was
doing. Well, the nightclub industry was a dangerous place that way, right?
Yeah. I mean, she would pop between Izzy's and the Cave back and forth.
But don't you think a lot of singers who are in the business, like you, that toured a lot of whatever, if they had any kind of tendency towards alcohol and or drugs, it was tough because a lot of it was around. Sometimes that's even how you were getting paid partially.
There were times when we got paid by drugs. I'm not going to deny
that. Justify.
Back in the day, you know, the cocaine was a lot cleaner than it is today, you know. And people are dying because they're putting fentanyl and stuff in it. We had clean cocaine. I mean, this stuff was fine. You only needed two one-in-ones.
You just sounded like Donald Trump there. Yeah. Clean coke.
But you admittedly, like, by getting into that stuff and touring so much and being in the drugs or whatever, it did cause problems for you at times.
Oh,
you
know, yeah.
With your family, with your relationships.
Wife.
You know,
kids,
how people saw
brothers,
you.
Brothers, you know, uncles.
I mean, people were unkind to you about your drug use, actually, is the truth.
It wasn't as bad as some people might have think. You know? Yeah. I experimented, but once I got to know what was happening, I let it alone. I didn't let anything really grab me.
Yeah.
I would never let anything really hook me.
Yeah.
If it was too good, it was like, okay.
I heard that.
Yeah, well, let's get back to Shirley Granger. Like, let's play a track now. But, you know, this is local history. And, yeah, it's hard to say where she went after this or how long she was around for. And maybe the alcohol or the problems, you know, meant she wasn't around
for. She drank a whole bunch. I think after a while she just put it all away and just, you know, sang at home and had her drinks.
Oh, well, that's anyway, sad. Let's listen, because she's a great talent, so let's listen to some local history right here. He means more to me. there you go. Some local Vancouver talent from 1977, right, Jason?
That's right.
Yeah.
And I look at the album here and I say, Dick Smith, man, he was one of the finest saxophone players locally, and he was from here.
Who was playing flute on that track?
I'm going to check and see. The flute player was Holly Burke, and that... She was a woman. I mean, you know, Holly. You know, she,
cool.
I only seen her once or twice. I can't. But she was really good with the reeds as well as, you know, the flute, man. She was good.
Who else is on this one that you know?
Henry Young. What
a legend.
Bring up a legend.
Yeah.
In his own time here in Vancouver, and he had everybody. He was basically on every recording that left locally from Vancouver because he was...
He'd get a lot of gigs.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we'd get to fill in with different people.
Well, he also did for major acts, too, because they'd come up here and work.
They'd need a pro.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they'd just hand him the music, and he would write charts for everybody in the band. He was the man.
Right. Speaking of the man,
uh-oh,
let's talk about this main man track that's on your 1975. If the listeners haven't heard before, Jason, here in Vancouver, he made a soul, funk, and rock album in 1975. Before that, he had his soul, psych soul group, The Trials of Jason Hoover, and then originally in the 60s, it was The Epics. But this was the first time in 75 that he got to make an album, right?
Oh, and I was promised so many times by other people, you know, New Syndrome, you know, Epic.
The Epics.
Oh, we're going to give you an album deal, three-album deal, Jason. Yeah. It never happened. But when we got Moth Mushroom and Jack Hirshhorn set that up for me...
But Jack Hirshhorn wasn't to do with the Mushroom record, though, right? He was the one that set up the whole place up.
Yep.
So he got you together, like you met Mike Flicker.
Oh yeah,
who's the producer of the of your 75 album? Yeah. The cover is controversial. Tell us about the cover.
Oh man, I didn't like it. I didn't even want it. I didn't want this album. My sister still hates it. She says she hates this album. Why couldn't I just put your arm underneath your chin and your beautiful face? Why didn't they put that on? I said, I was so upset too. But it was somebody's, if you look there, you'll see who's, you'll find out who's the one that came, that actually had the idea to do the album. And I talked to him as I were doing this. I says, man, this is crazy. You got all these people biting apples. And
But, I mean, Kirk here thinks, and we were talking about this, that it is actually a little bit ahead of its time, right, Kirk?
Yeah, I think anyone who would look at this album cover today would get the instant irony and sort of, tongue-in-cheek approach to, you know, just explaining the situation of the black man in North America for the last 400 years, which is, you know, here's this guy, you know, with this beautiful afro, yet he's wearing this all white suit, you know, all white, you know, and he's in a white room, and even the tree is white.
How about that?
And in a white town, I might add. Yeah.
You know, like, come on. And then, of course, he's biting the apple, you know, and then there's a bunch of apples he's bit on, you know, sitting right there. So it sort of speaks to the hidden reality of the black history everywhere, you know, like since blacks have moved to North America in a larger way. And I think if a lot of people, if they saw this album cover for today, they'd be like, holy shit, that's dope. You know,
it's clearly something ironic about it, because look at all the supposed bites of the apple. They represent all the opportunities Jason put his energy out there to create. Yeah. And, of course, he didn't get to eat the whole apple because somebody was like, we ain't having this.
Just like Jason, the sense of his optimism, you know, on the cover is actually who he is. You know, he's biting the apple, but he's smiling.
I was happy. I was very happy to have this attention. But, wow, I was really upset. I was really upset that they put me in white and white shoes on.
They told you what to wear. Okay. Oh, okay. That's even deeper.
Yeah.
I mean, my idea for an album would be like, you know, fine suit or a nice shirt, and you give that old pose, you know, the old standard pose.
We'll make that happen with the movie.
I can't wait.
We won't make you wear all white. Not anymore. You know, things are going to change now, bro.
Thank you, David. It's about time. It's about time.
I'm the only one probably that you'll ever sign a contract where it'll be a fair deal, finally.
I hope so. I think it will, David. You've been always so fair to me. I think that when we do put this video out, or as you call it,
film together.
Yeah.
It's going to be more than
a
video.
It's going to be a movie, basically.
Yeah. At this point, it's no longer a short.
No video.
All right, well, let's talk about this track, Main Man, because on this track, on the Mushroom album, you wrote the lyrics, because you have a co-writing credit there, and you know, you're talking about traveling down to L.A. from Vancouver. So it really... It like in 75, to the viewer out there, or like in the film, it's really going to put the viewer in an insight into what Jason Hoover was thinking about in 75. You know, you're traveling down the highway to LA. I guess that was your life then. And you were on tour, and anyone who had a relationship with you has got to understand.
The one that led to LA was the most exciting, you know, palm trees, man, beautiful girls, beaches, you know. That was my main goal, man, to make it in California. I said, to heck with Toronto, to heck with New York, man. Get me to L.A., man. Yeah. No, that's all I really wanted at that point in time, 1975. I finally got there, but my fame didn't follow me. It actually preceded me and went out the door.
But you can hear the optimism in your voice, and, you know, you're going down to L.A. because the record was mastered down there, and so these things were happening. And, you know, it was, you can hear the optimism, but it's a bit bittersweet, isn't it?
The song, when I wrote it, was meant to be bittersweet.
Yeah. No. All right, well, let's check it out now. Right. This is Jason Hoover, locally made 1975 album, Main Man.
You may think I'm possessive, but I'm really not that way. I don't want to lose your love, but I know that I can. If you don't realize, I'm gonna steal your man. Traveling down the highway from Vancouver to L.A. A love I consider true, but I know it's not easy when I'm away from.
Indeed, local history, ladies and gentlemen, here on African Rhythms Radio on CITR 101.9 FM, UBC Radio. And that is Main Man. Yet another, I mean, we're talking, there was 4 7-inch singles released off this album. And if you think that's a good tune, it wasn't even one of the hits. And there was 5 records pitched as hits on the album. We've already played some of them before on the show. But this is actually a 6th or 7th good track on the album.
That's exactly right. And what made Jason's stuff stand up is that nobody sounded like him. Yeah. His musicians and his lyrics are clever. Yeah. You know, Kirk made the aside about how he was talking in the lyric about what was going on in his life and stuff like that.
Yeah.
That's the essence of every writer. You're supposed to write about the things that are most familiar to you. Yeah. And he did that, and he was accompanied by a great musical score there.
Yeah, they were in the groove.
Yeah, it's funny. I wonder, that's got to be the first time Vancouver's ever been mentioned in a song.
Yeah.
Especially a soul
You're
song.
Right. Traveling on down to L.A. from
no,
Vancouver.
That's a, no, that then, really, that's yeah. a great point. Because
yeah, that is a big
we
point.
Were talking about all the years that he didn't get any love locally. And he mentions Vancouver. I mean, Bobby Taylor had a group called the Vancouvers, but when was Vancouver ever mentioned in a song?
Jason went to Hollywood, but strangely enough, our collaboration with the folks, the director of this film in Sydney, are living in Hollywood now. So Hollywood's finally getting ours back on our own. So it's, you know, maybe your idea was just ahead of its time, really.
I think that I was ahead of my time. Well, even if you listen, you survive listening to this album and hearing it today, it's still a little bit more happening. It's still a little ahead of us.
I keep getting flavor. Into new tunes all the time, which exactly. shows you the longevity of the album is mm-hmm. that it's consistently good. And, you know, next we're going to listen to the one that three years ago when we're shooting the film, and we go home that night, and there's a big uproar because Jimmy Fallon has done a spoof on the record, played this next track, but just the instrumental scat part, pretended it was an instrumental, and kind of, frankly, made fun of it a little
he
bit.
He did. Yeah, he was basic. Spoofing it, although Quest was kind of nodding his head and whatnot to the all that. But the ironic part was when that video was first created, he had like 2,000 views.
Yeah.
after the Jimmy Fallon spot, it went up to over 200,000.
Yeah.
And that was in less than 24 hours.
That's right.
The strange thing is they've pulled the video off YouTube. So if we wanted some in our film, I mean, of course, you know, this went out to a lot of people around the world at being on Jimmy Fallon. So, of course, we're going to want to try to get that into the film. It's, again, part of local history. You know, I mean, we were talking about on another show how Bobby Taylor, when he was here in 2008 and flies down to Philadelphia, does a project, Motel meets Philly, and there was not even one iota of local press. Nobody even mentioned it. You know?
That's why I mean, keep saying the thing speaks for itself. Vancouver had every opportunity to become Canada's sole station. That's base for all of the talent that would eventually spread itself out. We can even go back from when Jason was popular to present day and ask the question, who represents Canada when it comes to soul, R&B, and funk?
It's a problem throughout Canada, and we're going to be talking about Carla Whitney in a minute, and how she put out her record in the same years as Jason's in 75. But let's talk about this track, Second Lady. I mean, you scat in this track. How'd you come up with that idea?
I was just playing around in the studio while we were trying to figure out how we're going to get this song happening, because there were some good things that we wanted to use. So I said, well, listen, let me just do a little bit of skit scatting, and... it worked.
Does it ever work?
Yep.
Well, this song has now, in its own way, helped tell the local history and the history of Jason Hoover. Mm-hmm. This song is now intertwined in your history through what's happened. So let's check it out next here on African Rhythms.
We don't scat in Edmonton either.
Exactly.
My heartbeat chilling. Won't you to listen to my heartbeat? All right. She's gonna do you lots of harm, chilling. If you stick that needle in your arm, watch out.
There's no escape. There's no escape from the drug of hate. No. Oh, no escape.
The Mushroom album, made right here in Vancouver, Jason Hoover, 1975, but mastered down in L.A. too. Was any of the overdub singers, backup singers, put on then?
No,
anything like
were,
that?
The girls, Clyde King and her gang, were all from Los Angeles, and they did studio work for everybody.
Right. Mm-hmm. So that would have been put on once the tapes went down to L.A.
Hmm?
Once the tapes went down to L.A., they'd
yeah,
add them.
Yeah.
So that stuff was added later.
With Flickr. Yeah. They went down with Flickr.
Right, yeah. So what else would have been done down in L.A.?
Well, we had, if you remember, you know, the violins and all that
right.
kind of stuff.
I see. Sort of post-production, orchestral, that kind of thing.
We used those.
Yeah.
No locals. It was all Los Angeles done. So,
because mastering had to be done in L.A. because it couldn't be done here. You can record
right
here, but there's no mastering here.
The master studio is right there in Capitol Records where everybody did their mastering, you know, with the leaning
tower.
So
it's not so easy to master, Mike.
It's not easy to master.
It
but again,
tough.
If you don't have great musicians, you're lost. You know, the percussion and the drum work by King Arison, and for those who don't know, Arison was a producer and performer. He had a couple
had his solo albums out.
Manhattan Love Song, which was a big track in the 70s and stuff. And he did a lot of work for Mike Theater, who did stuff like The Bull and Cosmic Wind,
disco.
Things like that.
Yeah.
He was doing disco. But, you know, you got top flight musicians. When you mix that with the vocals and the clever lyrics and all that stuff, that's part of the reason why he doesn't sound like everybody else. You know, when the Mizell brothers were doing their fusion thing in the 70s, they were all locked into this group speak and whatnot and repetitive stuff.
Yeah.
You got all these chord changes going on in this song and stuff. It's like, it's a huge piece. And it's like one thing out of nine that says, this is who I am. You know, and we were talking earlier about Robert Christgau, who was the longtime music writer for the Village Voice and the record reviews that he used
from
to do.
From New York.
He would have played this. He would have played this and he would have rated it fairly because it was about writing about good music. He even
I mean, again, Mike, we're talking Love Will Get You, She's My Lady, Sing Me Some Soul. Like, all these were singles. Show Me Some Slack was not a single, although, you know, it was internationally known. But, I mean, four singles, and even Sing Me Some Soul was the B-side of one of the singles.
Exactly. I mean,
this is the now sixth and seventh tracks on the album.
I'm not blowing smoke up his butt. I mean, we already friends. I'm just saying, quality stuff stands the test of time.
Quality is quality.
We could have heard this
20, 30 years ago, I thought, oh, man, this is all right. We're hearing it now, and we're still saying the same thing. No, this is all right, you know. And so
it's hard to even get to all the good tracks on the Mushroom album because there's a lot of depth and diversity there. But interestingly, at the same time, Jason, that you put this album out, here was Choka Campbell coming up from Motown, moving to Canada, and working with this Carla Whitney, this unknown singer out of Toronto. And because she was so unknown and didn't get the accolade, you didn't get to hear her.
No, you know, I never got to hear.
How much soul did you get to hear in Canada? Not enough. When the Night Train
Review
and everything
was gone.
The most
I heard outside of Vancouver, I have to attest, it was Montreal. Those people were just coming up all the time from New Orleans, up from New York,
Right. So Montreal was a hotbed.
Yeah, it was a hotbed for funk and soul.
Right. So, although there was the odd thing happening in Toronto, like, say, Carla Whitney, and then out here, we've covered Shirley Granger, a soul, funk, and jazz singer that was here. Rael Johnson, we've mentioned. Mm-hmm. Many of the others disappeared, like Soul Unlimited and Night Train Review in this particular period were all gone.
Well, they were basically, like you say, soul. I would call Soul Limited because they didn't have a chance to stretch out to do anything.
Never made an album.
Yeah, and Night Train Review never got to be reviewed.
The Soul Train, Soul Unlimited actually made an album that Jamie, Rob's friend, has that never came out. And then Night Train Review, they just had that one song that came out, Cy Risby, Ain't Life Wonderful. Yeah, so wonderful. They didn't really, except for Live at the Grooveyard, right? Which is a record you were on.
We all did Live at the Groove.
Yeah. All the soul groups were on this one album that they only made something ridiculous, like 100 copies or something.
Exactly, so that's not really doing anything. It's not even a tease. If they were going to make 100 copies, then they should have went to 100 different record executives across Canada.
Yeah.
And they didn't do that because it was supposed to be a sample.
It does capture the local scene, though. Yeah. Like it's a time capsule that captures all the hottest bands at the time. The Epics, the Night Train Review.
Soul Unlimited.
Like, all the biggies are all on there.
It begs a better question before you play this. Because we always thought, what would happen if Jason had gone to Toronto instead of Vancouver? So this would be a good indication because the answer just might be that he might have had just as many roadblocks in Toronto as he
You could have been singing on the same bill with Carla Whitney. Well, let's check her out now because the interesting contrast, Canadian and out of Toronto and in the same year as Jason's album. Yet the production sounds much more vintage and not so up to date as yours. It's quite a contrast, in fact. Let's check it out. Carla Whitney. How about that? I mean, she's uh, She's got some big talent in that voice, but what a contrast that in the very same year that you got this incredible production and mastering in LA, here's Carla Whitney. She clearly wasn't on the same with the same crew. No.
And she was in a different part of the country too, though, yeah. which would have an effect on the way she projected and the way it was mixed. It's just the way, you know, Philly, Detroit, New York. You go to Toronto, Montreal.
Clearly, Toronto Vancouver. Didn't seem to have big budgets and studios for soul musicians. I don't know. There's something going on there.
No, yeah. After the first minute, it finally kicked in, but the production was so tinny.
Yeah.
It didn't have any bass to it. It had no meat.
Yeah. Mm.
It's really, I mean, it is really an indication, though, overall in Canada, were we celebrating our own, you know, our soul culture and history? How much has it been celebrated, period?
Yeah.
Look, we can walk a line between Jason and present day. We can kind of, first the everyday people, what I like, Deborah Cox, you know, Remy Shan. You know, how many acts, real Canadian acts, born here, played here, grooved here, give you soul and R&B?
Not enough.
This you know, it's interesting because this relates a lot to movie making and sound and movie making. Like, one of the differences is that a lot of American shows, they'll pay the extra dollars to get like real, real needle drop music, while the Canadian producers, they'll always try to find a cheaper way to do it because they just don't want to pay. They don't want to pay the cost of putting good music on the tracks and
put money into the music.
Exactly, and that's the big difference. You can hear the difference in sound between American and Canadian shows, and people don't know what it is. They look at the picture and it's kind of the same, but it's the sound that's different.
But you know that when you look at Jason's Mushroom album and you look at the production value and the musicianship that was on board, like, it certainly was of a quality to market to a bigger.
Well, he did the work. You know, he had the input. Maybe this young lady didn't have as much say in what was going on from what the producer was doing in the control room. Yeah. You know, like, sing this, give me one take or two takes, boom, we done. You know, Jason was putting all kinds of good stuff in there and whatnot, and there was a reason why it was working. When they took it down to California to have the post-production done, it was already a done piece.
Yeah,
it was
Mike. It was.
But you can see that by, you know, the quality of the backup singers, by King Erickson being on it, whatever, that what was put together was as good quality as anything else that was around. So then it really just comes down to the marketing.
It's not a surprise it's good. When those musicians finished in there, they left there thinking, all right, this is some good shit we put together.
That's
you
right.
know?
But but here's the thing, Jason. No matter if it was in the Tower Records in Los Angeles or whatever, a distribution deal for Mushroom Records, period, was not forthcoming. The only time it really happened, probably, was with the Heart record. You know, like, finally, they got that. They must have sold to some U.S. deal or whatever. But it seems that a deal was not forthcoming to the degree it should have been to market his record into the U.S.
But you also must remember that they didn't put that much money behind me because they were tentative. They were totally tentative. They didn't believe in it totally.
Thank you.
But with Heart, they believed in it totally, okay? And what I did basically was open doors for Heart. I was opening doors for Heart.
You came before Heart.
Yeah.
So although the focus was on you as well for a moment, the minute there was dollars to be made with Heart, they just dropped the bomb on you.
Yeah, they dropped the bomb.
And that's the fuzzy end of the lollipop, because if they hit a home run with Heart, then if I'm an exec in that office, and this is just common sense, something I was always accused of not having, you know, somebody would have said, all right, we got Heart off the ground. Now we can put some money into the Jason Hoover project. They didn't do that, and there was a reason why they didn't.
But they told me they were going
to. And it had nothing to do with your talent.
No, well, I mean, the indication that they were trying to appease the situation somewhat was the fact they released 4 7-inches from it. So that was like, okay, we want to put another one. And this next song, Love Will Get You, which is a very hooky ballad in its own right, like, let alone the Show Me Some Slack, Sing Me Some Soul, and the other great She's My Lady, the great songs on the album. I'd say that Love Will Get You is probably as good as all of them, I would have to say.
It reminds me of a Dobie Gray song.
Yeah,
I love Dobie Gray.
In the arrangement and stuff like that. So it's not an innocuous, oh, baby, baby, baby kind of love song and whatnot. So it would have been perfect for airplay anywhere. It would have worked anywhere. So
let's check it out, ladies and gentlemen, next. Probably the third or the second or third single released off the album? Third. Here we go. Love Will Get You, Jason Hoover, here on African Rhythms.
That's all right now, baby. I'll travel on. Oh, yes. Now they say your first love, he hurt you. Such a long, long, long time ago. And you've been so afraid. You've been so afraid now to let yourself go. Oh, 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 no. But I will bet you love will get you. I will bet you now, baby, that love will get you. Well, I guess I'll soon be leaving the thought of you behind. And maybe the next time now, baby, you won't be so blind. No, no.
Get you, Jason Hoover. What a track. You know what, those singers, they're priceless, you know.
Clydie King, that was her gang.
Yeah, and they were singers in Los Angeles.
Yeah, shit, he was Los Angeles, that's where we got them. And they loved our material. They freaked out for it. They really freaked out for the material because
they did
nothing
an ace
like that
job.
In Los Angeles.
Yeah. No, it's an ace ballad, and they did an ace job.
Like, oh, they did!
It's so perfect. It's the album is staggering. How many great songs are on your 1975?
You,
I mean, for a locally made soul record, it's tops. Like, there's not even
not
close.
Just that. You've got so many different styles going on. You got the jazz influences through some of the tracks. This was a straight up kind of old school, like Stax ballad.
That's right.
Yeah, it's very Southern.
Understated. Yeah. You know, the girls are singing in the background, like you might hear with the Sweet Inspirations of folks like that, or you know, famous backup
influenced
singers.
By gospel.
Exactly. Yeah. All gospel chords. It's all seventh, eighth, and ninths in that song and whatnot. So he kept it simple. It's like, you know, when you're a soul singer, when you're doing funk, you got to slow things down every now and then. You got to slow it down so the band can catch their breath. That's a perfect standalone, you know. People get solos on guitar. We got Mr. Kirk Moses. You know, that's it, but that's what they do. You know, that's how we do it on the stage. And that's how it should be done.
Yeah.
People get a full meal deal about what you're doing and what your act is doing, so they can appreciate your sound and the work that you put into it.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's fantastic work. It's
Jason Hoover.
It'll get you.
Okay, let's just grab that. Hang on a sec. All right, I'm sidetracked. I'll admit it. All right, so anyway, it's we've been talking about the Mushroom album, and we've been flushing out some of the songs that we hadn't focused on in the past, you know, which is always a good thing, you know, to just sort of get to the essence, because your history, it's complex when
it
you
is
go
complex,
when you go
huh?
when you go into all of it.
Oh.
And you know, you realize with that album that it's all completely different musicians than the rest of your career. The epics, some of the epics became the trials, but none of the epics and trials became the Jason Hoover solo album.
No, they didn't.
You know, it was it was all new, but look how good the musicians are.
It was nice to have the final say and everything. That is important. When you have a group and you're a part of a group, you're yep. dealing with four or five
That's
other
right.
suggestions mm-hmm. where I said, I want this, I want that, I want this. Hey, it's a great feeling to have, you know, it's mine. I chose the people. I chose how I wanted the sound and speed, everything.
Well,
the
quality speaks throughout the album.
Thank
but, you.
You
know, let's reflect on another singer from that same era. And this was actually the wife of Miles Davis.
Yes, wow. Betty Davis was nasty.
She didn't seem to mind speaking her mind.
No, she had that same raw quality that Tina Turner had. You know, this was
I love Tina Turner.
This was drifting toward the disco era. But yes, Betty Davis, or Betty Mabry, as she was before she was married, she was one of those gut bucket, you know, from the heart singers who would just go ahead and tantalize you because she was looking good on stage as well as singing well.
So. But socially conscious and kind of
yep.
deeper too.
Ice Cube said he took the sample from her track Once Upon a Time in the Projects, and he said that was his most requested jam. Yeah. You know, so
this may be one of those hip hop jams, anti love song,
yep.
Betty Davis.
No, I don't wanna love you, 'cause I know how you are. That's why I've been staying away from you. That's why I haven't called you, 'cause I know you could possess my body. I know you could make me scrawl. I know you could have me shaking. I know you could have me climbing walls. That's why I don't want to love you. You are sure you say you're right on and you're righteous, but with me I know you'd be right off, 'cause you know I could possess your body too, don't you? You know I could make you crawl, and just as hard as I'd fall for you, boy. Well, you know you'd fall for me hard. That's why I don't wanna love you. Cause I know what you do to my heart. You scorch it just like a hot iron. Leave me burning alone in the dark. 'Cause I know you could make me suffer. I know you could drive me mad. I know you just take me in a circle. And when it got real, I know you'd disappear. That's why I ain't gonna love you. Love you.
Sounds like the definition of the 70s to me, buddy.
Oh, you know that. I'm waiting for the wah-wah pedal and the homeboy to walk into the bedroom and whatnot. And the B-flip, porno style. Yes, yeah. I love that stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, nasty Betty.
No, I mean, Betty Davis, she was edgy for that time.
Yeah,
and it was probably hard for a woman to be that edgy, you know?
Yeah, she was good, though. I mean, she's the best singer I've heard tonight.
Yeah, no, she's...
And that's original material, by the way. That's another difference.
Anti-love song. Yep. Yeah, like I think she wasn't really afraid to be different, you know, to be...
I know the feeling.
Yeah. But, you know, another guy that was really happening at that time in the 70s was Bobby Womack, you know.
I mean, Bobby Womack. He was the finest of all finds, man.
Yeah, it just seems like he kind of... He really nailed the feeling in a song.
Yeah.
And like you were with your Mushroom album, he was able to get really top level musicians around him.
Mm-hmm.
People that were like, it was an honor to be on his album kind of thing.
Well, he was like Bill Withers in the sense that
Bill Withers,
he was going to play what he wanted.
That's right.
He had his own ideas of what kind of concepts he was going to put together.
Mm-hmm.
And he was riding a couple of crests at that time because remember, Shaft, Superfly, those soundtracks that come out.
He even got in on that, actually.
He got in on that doing the soundtrack to Across 110th Street.
Yeah.
He had his hands in lots of pies, and he actually did his own movie, well, his soundtrack, Across 110th Street, and these ballads of his were always that.
Well,
I'm
you know,
sit
I mean,
down
if you
and
look
talk
at.
To you.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you look at the greatest Bobby songs or, you know, the anthem of anthems or whatever, I mean, certainly Stop on By, because not only was it Bobby, it was also Icantina,
you know,
had a hit with
Rufus,
it too.
Rufus did a nice version of that
exactly
as well.
Rufus did it as well, but I mean, this is, you know, this one, You're Welcome to Stop on By.
Yeah.
I mean, this is one of the big
stop
ones
on,
but
on,
the feeling on, yeah the feeling in the song,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it makes it pretty much as good as the best Marvin Gaye, you know. I mean, it's right in there.
It's why we got to play our own stuff. This wasn't going to get played on a pop station or a rock station. You know, this really speaks to have an identity music that verifies our culture. And that's
this
where
was a number one R&B
to.
Chart song,
that's right.
But yet it
but
wasn't
you weren't
a
hear it, even You wouldn't even hear it in Philly or New York. This is a Southern market song.
Yeah,
you're
going
to hear this in Memphis.
Only in certain markets.
Exactly. You're going to hear it in Memphis, Atlanta, Miami. You'll hear it down there.
Stacks.
But you ain't going to hear it up north.
All right. Well, let's check it out because this is such an anthem. Mm. Bobby Womack, you're welcome to stomp on by.
Turning your love away, even though I know it's belonged to another man.
Oh, baby.
You know, when you look in my eyes, I'm gonna say these words. Girl, you're welcome.
Stop on by. You know I'll be here, baby. To dry your eyes, but I'm getting tired of being that second guy. Don't you be no fool, baby, you're about to lose your old standby. Listen, is it the material thing that is given? Girl, you're welcome. Stop on by. Stop on by. But one day, I might be the one to make you cry. Think about it, baby.
Is it the material things that the man is giving? Yeah, can you truly say that you're happy living? True love, I'm the one that's giving. Yes, man. I'm trying to keep a good feeling. Oh, stop on by. Stop on by. I'll never turn back. Yeah, I will always put you down. Maybe you can talk it over. Let's go to stop on by. Girls, I really know you. I've been knowing you a long time. Come on in. Stop by. Oh, come on in, baby. Sit down and talk it over.
All-time anthem of anthems. You're welcome to Stop On By.
There you go.
Yeah, I mean, it is like... influenced by Marvin, but Bobby was kind of a world unto himself. Hey,
he was different, even though he was the same.
A natural.
That's deep. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He was different, even though he was the same. He was doing the same type of music.
Okay. I mean, he was Pickett back in the '60s, guitar player.
That's right.
So he, he had, he learned a lot from the Wicked One.
He That's did. Right. But and a good song's a good song, and just like Bobby was cutting it off there in the Rufus version, she comes back in. And the bass player is just walking that line.
Oh,
and they come back to the stop on by. Yeah. A good song you could do anything to. And the translation matters when you have the right people who understand the spirit of the song and just let it loose. So
well,
I'm
Rufus
not surprised.
Mike Rufus had the epitome of the band. I mean, the band that was with Chaka was fantastic. Mm-hmm. I mean, the bass player.
Yep.
I wonder whose came first. I think Rufus maybe came out after
Rufus
this one.
Rufus came after this one. That's definitely, but yes.
But no, I mean, they're equally good. But actually, the next track on this album, You're Messing Up a Good Thing.
Mm-hmm.
This is another fantastic Bobby moment. I mean, other people have done this song, like John Edwards, for instance. But wow, I think we're going to have to play
Edwards
two in a row.
John Edwards did it after.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
John Edwards was great.
Yeah.
Okay, let's restart it. We didn't do it right.
No. we're having a good ball. That's right. We're having a good time down here in the studio at CITR FM 102. African Rhythms with Mike and David and Kirk and Jason.
I'm not that kind of man. You're always accusing me of saying I'm doing you wrong. But if you don't believe I'm working, why are you staying at home? I'm trying my best to give you the thing you never had, but you twist around everything I say just to make me feel bad, baby. Yeah. Keep on fighting this way. Yeah. I can't understand it. Oh, girl, I really love you. And it hurts to see you cry. It's just as hard for me to come home as it is to say goodbye. Darling, you're mine. I'm not doing what you say I do. Girl, I tell you everywhere I go. Chuck it if you wanted to. Why do you complain so much? I'm sacrificing too. Is it because you don't love me as much as I love you? Hey, baby, hey, baby. I keep on calling.
Jason. So, I mean, it appears you weren't the only one having some relationship difficulties in the early mid-70s.
I'm sorry.
Seems that Bobby's expressing some of his blues through his song there.
Yeah, Bobby Womack was the greatest when it came to... But you said he worked... He was guitar player for Wilson Pickett. You can hear Wilson Pickett all through his stuff.
Yeah, you can. Those little screams you kind of learn from the Wicked One.
Oh, yeah.
And learned a few other tricks. And learned from the other interesting connection with Bobby, of course, his relationship with Sam Cooke. Because he toured with Sam Cooke, and he learned a lot from him. He dated Sam Cooke's wife after his death, so that was very controversial at the time. Bobby had a lot of problems with partying cocaine. I mean, he was in that There's a Riot Going On party session with Sly, which was three straight days of
he actually kind of wrote about that when he did the song Daylight, when he was talking about the party going on,
staying up all night
on the lawn.
Another anthem.
Yeah, he wrote about all of that. But Jason hit it on the head. It's the phrasing.
Yeah.
Because that dictates how you sound to everybody. And when you don't sound like everybody else, that's what you want. Because as soon as that needle drops,
that's
you hear
you.
Him or Bobby or Sade or Chaka, you know who they are as soon as the music starts. You can't buy that.
It appears that song, again, you know, we've been touching on some Southern soul tonight. Ivy, Quinn, those are Southern guys again. Mm-hmm. And that's when you wanted raw... Kirk was asking about, you know, the difference between Stax and Motown, and that is it, really. Like, it's a nod to the South. It's a nod to real musicianship.
It is a nod to real musicianship because Motown was more formulaic. They were mid-tempo. Everything they did was...
There was no solos, hardly.
There were no solos, and, you know, and we were talking about My Girl before we left here. You know, as great a ballad as My Girl is, it's not a, you know, stay in my corner, you know, didn't I blow your mind this time kind of ballad, because they're in a different tempo. Motown made sure it was like your touch dance like they do on American Bandstand where you can't get close and stuff like that. That's what that was. And even though it was popular, it didn't define what a real ballad was, although it sold like goo gobs of copies.
Well, if you look at how Jason's sound changed from the Epics up to 68 and then the psych soul of the Trials, and then... You get into the mid-70s, and then you play another Canadian-produced album from that same year. Mm-hmm. I mean, what a contrast that was on this show tonight, was just to be able to see how far your production had come along. Because even with the Trials, as great as those songs are, whatever, they don't quite have the sophistication of a Mushroom Studio L.A. mastering production.
No.
I mean, that was quite a long way to come in 3 years.
I really enjoyed the journey. The journey was good.
It's one hell of a journey. Yeah, I mean, the more we learn about it, it was one hell of a journey. But it kind of upsets me at times, you know, whenever I talk to all the other people that have known you and all the people you've interrelated with or whatever, just what's nitpicked sometimes, you know, about the ups and downs and whatever. Like, it upsets me because I'm like, that's what happens in this town in Vancouver, is that people complain and they don't realize what they've got when they've got it sometimes.
Thank you. You could have had Jason and Bobby Taylor being a vanguard for a talent that would have defined Vancouver as a music town. I mean, music is part of a collective culture. Culture, that reflects everybody, every human being on the planet. Mm. And if you're blessed to be in an area where you can hear certain things, certain sounds, and that represents you or part of you, you embrace that. I don't know of any city that... Can you imagine New Orleans not embracing Louis Armstrong?
Oh, wow.
Or the Preservation Hall Jazz Band.
Or the Preservation. Exactly. That's my point. It's like, how can Vancouver drop the ball on this? That's the only question that's worth asking.
Really, this film, in all honesty, really, it's calling Vancouver out on this.
That's
and we're going to slam them with, you know, the multitude of what really was going down.
That's right.
I mean, even that concert that we've been talking about and playing all this time, I Want to Testify, Funky Broadway, The Wind Cries Mary, an incredible version of the Jimi Hendrix.
Nobody has ever even heard it. Exactly.
But I mean, the key to it all is that it's not only black local soul history, but it has never, except for possibly 30 seconds of it, nobody's ever seen any of it. Like, you know, this will be seen by the world when we put it in this film for the first
time.
Think
about it, and ironic that Hollywood's getting involved in this. What was Vancouver from the 90s on? It was Hollywood North, right? Everybody
was doing Hollywood North. Everybody was
TV
talking Hollywood.
TV shows, movies, and all that.
That's right.
They embraced that. But why couldn't you embrace something that was right here, right in front of your face? You know, if he looked like Bryan Adams, we would be having this discussion because he'd have been blasted all over everywhere. You know?
Strangely, 60 Men, The Groove, it almost slightly, at a couple of moments, sounds like Loverboy or some of the other. Like, you can almost, except for when Jason starts singing, like, almost believe that
look,
for a sec. You
know? Vancouver, we ain't hating. All I'm simply saying to y'all is that they missed this.
Yeah.
They missed out, and because they missed out or wanted to or didn't want to, you missed out. And I
well,
think that's
we're
going to
hit them, you know, with... You know, where we're going with this film and the kind of quality that we're going to end up with this film, we're going to hit them with a lesson of lessons, I think.
You're going to do that. And that is the beauty of this movie that you're going to make. It's going to whip everybody's butt.
Yeah.
That didn't and didn't understand. And I that's why I want the movie to be so good, so that they'll come back again.
Well, I'm sorry, Jason. You know, for you, I'm sorry to have to leave it. To your 72 years old, to be able to finally get some respect.
Yeah, but I'm liking the
But the last 3 years, it's been building. It's building towards. It's just, it was a harder journey than we could have possibly imagined. Mm-hmm. But I'm a fairly dissatisfied kind of a dude. You know? it's got to be
Sherlock,
the best.
Everybody. There's still Sherlock.
Mm-hmm. And no, I mean, Mike, the same. Kirk, the same. Kirk's been involved with film. Mm-hmm. And he is going to contribute what he can contribute. It's a group effort, but we've now put the super team together. So you know, we're doing it on a different way, right? Kirk, give the mic to Kirk. Thanks for your involvement, Kirk. You know, it's great you're here from the local community, and we're able to meet even through a community meeting. Like that's the way we made the connection.
You know? Yeah, you know? Thank you for you know, it's very I would say what's that word when you meet someone just by chance. Because that night I was just sitting at home and my buddy Ray called me up and he's like, you got to go to this thing. It's happening. It's the Hogan's Alley thing. And I was like, yeah, okay. I'll, you know,
bringing back the black, you know, getting a black community center, low income housing into this new space after they pull down that stupid viaduct.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right. That's not there anymore. I didn't think about that.
No, they're pulling it down. It hasn't been pulled down yet, but it's happening. It's going to be dynamite. That thing is toast. You know, all the damage that caused, all the heartache and grief, it's going to be over. There's plans for it. But yeah, a good friend of mine who's been on the show before, a local poet in the black community, Siobhan Barker, I love her to death, and she just said, David, come on over here. I've got this editor friend I want you to meet. And that's how it all started.
You know? Yeah, it was like kismet, you know? Yeah.
We hit it off pretty much from day one. Yeah. I was like, I've just got to sell you to my team, that's all.
and I'm really excited because, I mean, like I said, I think this is like one of those career projects that you bring something special out to the world that people have never seen before, and they go, holy cow, how did I miss this, you know?
I'm glad that we've taken it as far as we've taken it. And, you know, I'm glad that, you know, we've got our notes organized. And thanks to Tara a lot for helping with that. And thanks to Harrison and Sydney for their commitment and interest. They're young, talented directors and producers living down in Los Angeles, but actually from here. Both of them have had success in the past with a TV show, but they've been producers and they've been filmmakers, and they're going to bring their talents to our film. So respect to them. And yeah, it's been a wonderful year, 2017, that all of these things have happened. And Mike and I, we always had the faith. Like, we never doubted it would be finished. Jason at times was worried, but...
You're absolutely correct. I was worried about both
of
you.
It's your life story. Like, of course you can have your worries.
I have nothing. I love you guys. I have nothing but faith.
Yeah.
You know, And you guys did it from the heart. It wasn't pushed on me. It wasn't done anything. It was being real. Mm-hmm. And I feel
we were of our words, basically. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, definitely. We gave you the promise, and it was relentless. We weren't.
That's why
I
know this movie's going to be dynamite.
When you look at all the ingredients, and you look at what we've got, and you look at even the entertainment value from what you've done, and the musical value, and the story. You know, I mean, the story, and, you know, part of the story is my plight to get it heard, and I can understand why they would want to put that into the drama, because it has been drama, you know? I mean, I've had a lot of heartaches with this film. I've had a lot of disappointments, you know? But I didn't say no. I never gave up. I never said
there is nothing harder to stop than an idea whose time it is has come to pass.
Yeah.
And Jason Hoover is no question what time it is.
Yeah, he knows what time it is. You know what time it is. You know what's up, I think the song once said.
Yeah, it's going to be great, you guys. Yeah. I'm really excited about the project. And David, you've put yourself out wholly for this, and it's not over.
You know what? People will help me. I mean, I don't have unlimited money. You know, whatever money I can come up with, I put on the line for this film. But it's not about money.
No, it's not about money.
It's beyond money at this point. You know, like, the process is in the works. And people will – help will come if help is needed. I mean, people will come together. It's about the community we're building, really. Like, it's a team effort. And there'll be many more people in the team. And, you know, many people behind the scenes are helping us, really, in many ways, and will continue to. You know.
That's great, especially the new ones that are coming up. And there's a young crop. Mm-hmm. It's like every 15, 10 years, there's a new crop. Mm-hmm. Well, we're on top of this new one that's coming up. And they're going to be... Like I told,
they need to know their history.
Yeah. Exactly, and we need to make Jason human, because once you make something human, you cannot dehumanize.
He cannot be denied anymore.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, he's been denied at times, sidelined, nitpicked, but being that I've been a DJ and I've been in the business and been in the spotlight with having the record shop, I understand a little bit about that. You know, I understand a little bit about unkindness or whatever, you know. So perhaps that's why I've been able to do this, in a sense, is that I can empathize, really, with how hard that is. Mm-hmm.
It is hard. But, you know, I just don't let it stop me.
We're relentless kind of people. All right, well, listen, I'm David Love Jones. That was Michael Ingram, and that is Jason Hoover, and that is Kirk Moses, and I want to thank all of them
for
showing up here.
Wonderful dude.
Yeah, and this is part of our super team, and you're going to be hearing more in 2018 about this film, but we're going to go out with Leon Ware, but take it out, my friend Mike.
All right, from Kerrisdale to Kitsilano.
There you go.
From Strathcona to Surrey. If y'all want to know where the soul trees grow, the roots of all of this good stuff can be found right here on African Rhythms.
Peace and love.
All righty. That was nice, Mike.
Thank you.
Turning off when you wanna turn.